Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
Welcome to another exciting episode of Reconstruction with David Taylor and Phil Bishop from the Construction Index. It's Wednesday, the 6th of July, 2022, and it's time for us to talk once again about what's been going on in the UK construction industry over the past fortnight. Might not be quite as exciting as what's been going on in Westminster over the last couple of days, Phil, but we'll do our best to make it interesting, shall we?
Well, you talk about Westminster. I happened to be at a wedding reception yesterday evening, last night, on Tuesday evening this week.
Oh, right.
I'm probably talking foreign language to you here, David, because you don't understand these things. But I've been at many a wedding in the past where I've been more interested in what's going on either in a football match or a test match or Wimbledon final or something like that. And you get a certain segment of the, I was going to say, audience. What do you have? The guests that are at the wedding reception are more interested in what's happening elsewhere in the outside world. This is the first time where I've been at a wedding reception where I've actually been more interested in what's been going on at Westminster at the time. When the news of the big resignations broke, I got a text and my phone clicked or vibrated or something. Yeah. Oh, I must have a quick look at that. Oh, my goodness. And I think a lot of people were glued to their phones rather than to their, worrying about what was going on the dance floor.
Oh, dear, that's a shame.
Oh, no, it's very exciting. It enlivened it up no end.
Well, I suppose it did. It doesn't seem to have borne any fruit. I mean, it's a shame that everybody else is resigning except the person who should be resigning, but that's just my personal opinion.
We are talking, listeners, at 10:30 the morning after. So I think by the time anyone listens to this, I think things might have moved on.
Anything might have happened, yeah. So we'll leave that to one side for the time being. There have been some interesting developments in the construction industry over the past fortnight, haven't there, Phil? One or two interesting announcements.
Some big stories breaking, yes.
Comments, yeah.
Well, should we start off with, let's stay in Westminster, shall we, or Whitehall at least?
Yeah.
Since we last spoke, one of the big things that's happened, on the 28th of June, the Building Safety Act 2022 came into force. Now, we talked about this before because it got royal assent at the end of April, 29th of April, and I think we discussed it after that, so talking about what it means and so on, I think, if memory serves. And you know, we're all sort of familiar with what it was. For example, the new organisations, the new quangos that are being set up, the New Homes Ombudsman, the Office for Product Safety and Standards, the Building Safety Regulator, and all this sort of good stuff officially came into force on the 28th of June. And I find it kind of fascinating that this government's been banging on, the Tories have been banging on for so long about the bonfire of the quangos and reduced red tape and, you know, one in, two out in terms of regulations and so on.
Yeah.
And it's piffle. I mean, it just get more and more, you know, laws and regulations and red tape. And on the whole, I mean, as far as the government is concerned, in terms of the not looking towards the construction industry, but looking towards the electorate, the headline that they would like to put out there is it's protection for leaseholders against having to pay for cladding replacement. And I think that is universally regarded as a good thing, that leaseholders shouldn't have to be shafted in the way they have been in the 5 years since the Grenfell Tower fire, which is what spawned all of this legislation.
Yeah,
but there's an awful lot more to it than that. And we did report back in April, the end of April, when the legislation received royal assent, that there were various construction industry bodies having some qualms about some of it. The fact that the role of the building safety manager was deleted from the legislation quite late on in its passage, just a month before royal assent. And Construction Industry Council sort of expressed concerns about that. And there have been concerns about the whole professional indemnity insurance market. And other issues that people have spoken out about. Mm-hmm. But no one's come out and said, oh, it's outrageous that we've got all these new quangos, because people sort of accept that, well, you know, maybe we need them. Although they're not as quangoy as we might think, because the building safety regulator is basically a sign on a door within
the HSE.
Exactly. Right? It's a new sign on the door within the HSE. Yeah. And they didn't need to create the office. They could just say, right, HSE, you're going to have to look out, you know, make sure you look after that like you're supposed to anyway. And the cladding police, the building products regulator, that's part of the Office for Product Safety and Standards, which already exists. And trading standards already exist. And they already had these. And it's like so many of these legislators. they want to legislate for something before actually making existing legislation work. You know, give it the money. Give trading standards, for example, the money that they need to do the job properly.
Yeah.
So if you cut through it, you didn't really need a lot of the legislation. You just needed to do better what we were supposed to be doing in the first place. But for me, the thing that really caught my eye in the wake of the or shortly after the Building Safety Act coming into force was comments made by the chief executive of Wilmot Dixon, Rick Wilmot. Did you read this?
Yes, I did. Yes, I was quite surprised actually. I'm not really used to hearing him speak out quite so forcefully, but this was quite damning what he had to say about the Act, wasn't it?
Well, I think it's the vigorousness of the language which struck.
Yes.
And I'm going to quote what he said. "We are all beginning to decipher the retrospective impact of the new Building Safety Act at a time when many in our industry we'll be wondering how the widespread failure of the government's own regulatory and testing system has left building owners and their contractors facing uninsured and unquantifiable financial risks for residential properties certified as fully compliant within building regulations over the last 30 years. And he goes on, "It is a poorly conceived travesty of justice that shines a spotlight on popularist lawmaking." He said it's quite right that they found a solution to the problem of innocent occupiers of some dangerous buildings. In other words, the leaseholders not having to pay for cladding. But it's done this by making a scapegoat of the whole industry and throwing developers, contractors and their supply chains under the proverbial bus, rather than accepting the fundamental role that successive governments, their own regulators and agents have played in creating this mess. Now, that is something that needed saying, and I've not heard anyone else say that out in public and put their head above the parapet. But I think good for him for saying it. And why other people haven't been saying it more loudly, more strongly? I mean, this legislation's been 2 years in the making or longer. I mean, when was the Hackett Report published? I'm not sure, but if we have an organisation called the Construction Leadership Council, which exists to make to guide the government to make sure it doesn't go wrong in its governing of the construction industry, and I haven't heard publicly, and maybe they've been, you know, trying to bang heads together privately behind doors in the way that it'd be more effective to do these things behind closed doors, but I haven't heard a peep from the Construction Leadership Council saying this shouldn't be happening.
Well, I think it's interesting. the operative word there is leadership. I think we appear to have a dearth of leadership in the country at the moment, and nobody is prepared to actually lead by example. I think, though, we've got a situation here in the wake of the Grenfell fire, which was an appalling disaster and really shameful for the industry, that somebody has to carry the can. You can't escape the judgment, the judgment of the people on this. It's too bad an event for people to escape unscathed, if you like, or unaffected by blame. It's very easy for the government and for other people, campaigners and so on, to point the finger at the people who built Grenfell Tower and also installed this flammable cladding on other buildings. But I think what Rick Wilmot is saying here is that it's actually far more It's a deeper, more ingrained problem than just a,
systemic.
Systemic. That's the word I was looking for. That basically, that the system and the regulation allowed this to happen. So, you know, it was possible to specify a product which was officially okay and was deemed to be compliant with the regulations, but then proved to be inadequate and not compliant with the requirements, you know, the requirement not to be flammable, for example. And so basically what's happened is that people are, I suppose, using a sledgehammer to crack a nut. It's far more complicated than simply a failure of the supply chain to ensure safety in buildings. And that by pointing the finger at the developers, that the government's really just using a sort of scattergun approach. And in fact, although Rick Wilmot is the first person I've heard to actually, you know, turn the argument around and point the finger at the government and the establishment, if you like. Other people, I mean, the National Federation of Builders a couple of months ago said that, you know, this is unfair because, you know, there's Michael Gove getting all shirty with the developers and latterly with the product manufacturers and saying, oh, you've got to stand up and be counted and, you know, you've got to pay a compensation. Well, I think it was Richard Beresford, who's the chief executive of the NFB, said that, you know, what about the small house builders, you know, the small housing developers, the people who didn't install any of this cladding, you know, they don't work on high-rise buildings. These are developers who are still being expected to foot the bill, and yet they've had no hand in the malpractice, if you want to call it that, that's actually led to things like Grenfell Tower fire and other fires in high-rise buildings. And so, you know, it is unfair. Maybe life is unfair, and you know, you have to, you know, just swallow it.
Well, I wonder if there isn't an analogy with all these mass shootings that go on once a week in the USA.
And it is literally once a week, I believe.
Yes. So, I think given the horror that the Grenfell Tower was, perhaps the horrors of these mass shootings is perhaps analogous in that while the US approach to it is, you know, every time a nut job with an automatic weapon does this, they get, you know, probably shot or sent to jail or whatever. They're not addressing the underlying problem of the fact that nut jobs can get these automatic weapons very easily. And the whole gun culture and the prevalence of guns, and that politically they don't seem to be able to address that, such as the difference in culture over there.
Yeah.
Compared to what we have here in the UK, in Europe in general, I guess. And that in the same way in the construction industry, yes, there are bad actors who have both from the product manufacturers. I think actually the product manufacturers have probably been the bad actors. The contractors, the architects and the developers have just been a bit lazy and incompetent and taken things for granted. I don't think they've been bad.
And also been concentrating on cost.
Yeah.
So, you know, as they always do, there's a choosing the cheapest possible product. So maybe that's an issue. But I agree with you. I think the product manufacturers this is, I think, fairly well established that they've been a little bit too generous with their marketing hyperbole. And that's one of the main problems with the specification of the cladding and the insulation on Grenfell Tower. So, sorry, where were you going with that? I interrupted you.
I'm not sure. I just think that the idea that the contractors are somehow to, you know, blame for the for unsafe buildings. I mean, yes, they are actually, and I think Rick Wilmot shouldn't be allowed off the hook. And by Rick Wilmot, I mean all construction bosses, bosses of construction companies. The industry should not be allowed off the hook. It has screwed up, and it is right that I think that it is put under scrutiny and called to heel.
Yeah.
But in the same way that the, you know, when one of these horrible mass shootings happens in America, or we've seen them in this country too, let's not forget, but when these horrible atrocities happen, it is, of course, immediately the fault of the person that did it. The shooter is the person,
of course, who
is the guilty party. No argument. Yeah. But if you have a system that enables them to be so prevalent, the system has to be addressed, and only the government can do that.
Yeah. I mean, it's I think you're stretching it a little bit to make a comparison between mass shootings and disasters like Grenfell Tower, or both, of course, disasters in their own way. But I think the principle that you said is that people are almost willfully ignoring the elephant in the room, which is the system that allows these things to happen, and preferring instead to, I mean, because the National Rifle Association in America, they love to say that it's not the gun that kills people, it's the people with the guns that kills the people. So it's people killing people, not guns killing people. Therefore, everybody should have a gun. And so that sort of warped logic, I think, perhaps, you know, explains the mass shootings in America, and perhaps a similar willful ignorance of the root cause of something like Grenfell Tower applies here as well.
Anyway, you talked about lack of leadership in the industry and how Rick Wilmot is. I think he's setting himself up for being said, right, you're clearly a man who's going to put his head above the parapet. Time to you know, take a bigger job as an industry figurehead, maybe. I mean, certainly shown within his company. I mean, Wilmot Dixon is one of, I mean, lots of companies could stake claim to this, but it is among those companies, you could say, it takes a lead on employment issues, environmental issues, mm-hmm. and social issues, and charitable issues, its foundations, its working with offenders and ex-offenders, and all this sort of good sort of touchy-feely stuff, and it, you know, it's a competent company, and it's a good profitable business, and in many ways it is an exemplary construction contractor. And he, you know, he's a fifth generation family member to run the business, and has done so since how long has he been? He's been there about 15 years as chief executive, so he's done a stint, and he's still not that old. I think he got the job very young, so maybe there should be a bigger role for him in the industry, which leads on to the appointment or the selection that we have had recently of the new industry side chair of the Construction Leadership Council. Mm-hmm. Now, we spoke about this. We speculated who it might be. I thought it might be someone from the client side, because the previous three people in that post, David Higgins was HS2 chief executive or chair at the time. Then it was Andrew Wolstenholme from Crossrail. Then when Andrew Wolstenholme moved on from Crossrail, Andy Mitchell, the chief executive Thames Tideway, all big client organisations who are seen, therefore, as kind of neutral of the vested interests of the different parts of the construction industry supply chain. Anyway, the new man is Mark Reynolds, who basically is in some ways the next cab on the rank. So he was the deputy chair, I believe, and certainly chaired one of the big working groups within the Construction Leadership Council, and a very strong voice and a driving force. So personality-wise, it makes a lot of sense, and it's been widely welcomed. And everyone says how great that, you know, Mark Reynolds is someone who's shown leadership at Mace and has always been seen to say and do the right thing. Personality-wise, it makes a lot of sense. I just still think having a contractor figure in that particular role might, I don't know, if he's in as good a position to chair discussions between different elements of the construction supply chain.
Well, I don't know. I mean, how would you summarise his role? I mean, he's there to represent the interest of the construction industry.
But the construction industry doesn't have an interest. It is a coalition of competing interests. Not even a coalition. It's a melting pot of competing interests.
You could say that about any industry, can't you? I mean, well, if you were to choose a...
No, not if you're talking about the piling industry as an industry, or the house building industry. I mean, yes, there are big house builders pitted against small house builders, but construction industry is not really an industry.
Yes, it's a conglomerate of industries.
Yes.
Yeah, I see what you mean. I suppose the boss of Mace. I mean, Mace is an interesting company in many ways. It's it was created, I think, about 30 years ago, was it?
It's sort of a Bovis spin-off, I think.
That's right, yes. Ian McPherson,
chap,
I think, was the chap who set it up. And this was all sort of done in the sort of white heat of the reforming, or I suppose the beginning of the sort of attempts to reform the industry. Because there were developers like Peter Rogers' outfit.
Stanhope. Yeah.
And organizations like that, which had identified, you know, systemic problems in the industry, the inefficiency and the subby bashing and all the rest of it. And Mace was sort of created out of that, you know, that sort of way of thinking. And so I suppose its raison d'etre was really to sort of try and,
it's management contracting.
I know, to modern.
It was management contracting versus construction management.
Yes, that's
that was
right.
A big
yes,
debate.
Yes, precisely. Yes, exactly. So I suppose in a way it's different from the sort of traditional tier one organisations, you know, the Costains and the Balfour Beattys, in that it was the first of a new breed. So maybe because of that, because of its, you know, what Mace stands for and what Mace has done over the years, it's perhaps a little bit more, it's not client side, I'll give you that, but perhaps it has a different view to the traditional outlook of the construction, you know, or civil engineering contractor.
I suppose what you're saying is it's progressive rather than reactionary or whatever. And I think that's probably true as an organisation. But I think a lot of even traditional contractors are progressive.
They are now. Yes, I think they are now. Maybe they weren't at the time when Mace was set up. But I mean, I can't remember who it was. I think you did name somebody who you thought might fit the bill as the replacement for Andrew Wolstenholme. Andy Mitchell.
Well, I was saying that John Armit was probably too old. So
whoever it was,
it would have been a sort of a younger version of a John Armit, I think.
Yeah. Yeah,
sorry, John, exactly. If you're listening, you're not too old for anything, really.
I think he's got his hands full anyway. But I'm not sure who would have been. There aren't that many sort of client side personalities, I think, that I can think of offhand. But as you said, Mark Reynolds seems to be a popular choice, and he's, you know, he's got some history with the CLC. He's been there for a long time. He's quite influential and. Clearly, he can sort of, you know, pick up the baton and carry on where Andy Mitchell left off, I suppose.
Well, no doubt Rick Wilmot will be burning his ear and saying, sort it out, mate.
Hopefully. Talking about the way the industry was and the way it is now.
Yeah.
Some things.
Plus ça change is the phrase that comes to mind.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, another big story of the past couple of weeks. We reported this on the 24th of June. The Competition and Markets Authority has been looking into the demolition sector for the past year or two, something like that, exploring. And they've been it's visited the offices of all sorts of companies. And it came out on the 24th of June and said that it has provisionally found that 10 demolition specialists have been illegally colluding to rig bids for demolition and asbestos removal contracts. This is by rigging. They are they're basically acting as a cartel. It's our old friend cover pricing, where they decide up front who's going to get it, and everyone else puts in a bid which is substantially higher than the one that they're going to go to, so that they can divvy up the market between them. And I can't remember how, was it about 10 years ago or something? A whole bunch of contractors got busted for this as well, and they got big fines. Was it 100 million comes to mind? Fines were handed down for that?
I can't remember. It seems a long time ago. I'd almost forgotten about cover pricing, actually, and here it is again. So
yeah.
It's quite a bit of a blast from the past, really.
But it's I don't find myself entirely surprised, I'm afraid. I mean, the demolition industry is, I use the word progressive to describe contractors. Not many of them would be described. I mean, maybe one or two, you could say. But no, the demolition contractor tends to operate in traditional traditional ways. Are there any female bosses in the demolition industry? I mean, certainly must be.
Yeah, I can't think of any. I mean, maybe the culture is. I mean, certainly technologically and operationally, the demolition industry has changed enormously in recent years. I mean, the methods, I mean, they still blow things down. They don't swing balls up from cranes anymore. But I mean, it's a far more...
There's engineering sort of involved,
nuanced,
isn't there?
Activity.
It's more deconstruction than demolition.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So the way they do things has changed an awful lot.
Yeah, that's fair.
I mean, the safety record of the industry has improved massively. But I think, yes, maybe the culture is lagging behind a little bit. Certainly it would seem to be if you know, from this particular case. I always find it a bit strange that, you know, with people sort of point the finger at companies and say, you know, this particular demolition company has been found guilty. The reality, I suppose, is that it's not necessarily, getting back to the UK government, it's the bloke at the top who really carries a can at the end of the day.
Or should.
And so that's why, you know, you've got companies named and shamed here. It's not necessarily the people at the top who are guilty of this. It's their guilt maybe is not keeping a close enough eye on what's going on further down the operation. And so it's people in regional offices sort of cooking up plans between themselves and bidding for jobs and contract managers perhaps, you know, going off on a frolic of their own and not telling their bosses what they're up to. But yeah, it's still down on the ground at site level, perhaps things haven't really changed that much.
It is quite interesting. I mean, you used the expression in our last discussion about deputy heads must roll.
Yeah.
in context of another conversation. A couple of the contractors who have admitted their guilt and their collusion in this conspiracy put out statements saying, for example, Keltbray acknowledges the findings relating to isolated activities of a previous management team in a subsidiary business. In other words, yes, a subsidiary business. It's not us here at the top. Us bosses, we're clean. It's down there in that subsidiary business, a previous management team who we've got rid of. We've cleaned the stables. McGee said something similar.
Yeah.
These infringements took place under the previous ownership and leadership structure. McGee, of course, was sold by the McGee brothers to its employees last year. So it's now employee owned. So you have to, give the whole workforce have to carry the can.
It sort of muddies the waters, doesn't it? I mean, because yes, certainly some of these companies, some of these cases go back years, and so maybe the individuals have moved on. The management is new, ownership is new, so maybe they're entirely justified in saying, "Well, look, you know, yes, it's the same company, but you know, everything has changed." It's what was it about the broom?
Triggers broom. Well,
It's not actually the same organisation that it was when all this nefarious activity was going on.
You talk about safety.
I think last year I spoke to Brown and Mason when I was taking a look at the demolition sector, and I couldn't quite figure out their figures didn't seem to make sense, because they've suddenly fallen down the rankings. They had a turnover of about 15 million, when normally their turnover is 50 or 60 million. And so I phoned them up and spoke to the boss there, and it was quite enlightening to find out that the company, because it's a family-owned company, over the years it spun off various other, I think there were 8 separate businesses, all of Brown and Mason in the title, owned by different members of the family, all doing different, slightly different, although sort of interconnected things. And then the boss, Terry Brown, I think it was Terry Brown, forgive me if I got the name wrong, sort of decided he wanted out, and he actually put his business into administration. And then his son, who was running the plant business, the Brown and Mason plant business, took on everything. All the contracts were novated to him, and it went on. So it is, if you like, a different company that had no activity in demolition before. But of course, it's inherited the business from his father. Is it the same business? Is it a different business? It's hard to tell, isn't it?
Well, I'm not quite sure which Brown and Mason the CMA are going after, because in we had a report just a couple of weeks ago that Brown and Mason Limited had an accident on a fatal accident. An employee fell to his death when a rusty pipe bridge collapsed in February 2019 at a Scottish power station. Brown and Mason Limited was the contractor. But between that happening and it coming to court, it had gone into administration and changed its name to CBRO2 Limited, which was presumably a shelf company. And meanwhile, Brown and Mason Plant Hire changed its name to Brown and Mason Group Limited.
That's right.
And Brown and Mason's holdings became NRLB Limited. and so when it came to the prosecution for the power station fatality, it was this entity, CBRO2, which is in administration, which was prosecuted, and not technically Brown and Mason. So Brown and Mason's health and safety record in this instance was unblemished because it was a different Brown and Mason.
Yeah.
So I'm not quite clear which Brown and Mason the CMA are going after, whether the current CMA, because, well, it's not us, different entity altogether. So I'm not sure what happened there.
Well, exactly. Well, I can't answer that either. But I mean, I think it was probably, my guess would be, and of course it is only a guess, so if I'm wrong, apologies, is that probably they're going after Brown and Mason Limited, which was the, which was a demolition business.
Which doesn't exist. That's now CBRO2.
Which doesn't
Limited.
Exist. Yeah. Yes, exactly. Yeah. That went into administration, I think, in January 2020.
Oh, I've got September 2020.
Okay. Right. Maybe.
Sometime there anyway.
Yeah, but that was Brown and Mason Limited, and then it went transferred to his business. In fact, I think it was Nick Brown who told me that when it went into administration, its entire assets, contracts and order book were transferred to Brown and Mason Group, formerly known as Brown and Mason Plant Hire. And that's run by Nick Brown, son of Terry. So is it the same company? I don't know.
But it's
depends which way you look at it.
The incident happened, the fatality on the job happened in June 2019. And 3 years, right. 3 years to come to court is pretty good going as far as the HSE court hearings are. And I'm surprised we don't get more companies by the time they get to court for a health and safety prosecution. More companies haven't changed ownership because it normally takes, it doesn't normally, but it can often take a lot longer than that, can't it?
Yes, indeed. And there's a case in point reported this week. Did you report it this week? Last week? This week. About the access platform accident on the M25.
And that was Genie, Terex Genie. Yes, that was it. That was this week. That was Monday this week we reported that. I think the actual court ruling might have been last week, but I picked it up this week.
Well, this came as a real surprise to me because I'd forgotten about the incident, actually, because it happened 9 years ago. This was when...
exactly 9 years ago, yeah.
Yeah, a chap, his name was Rick Yeager Fossard. He was a foreman at Kimberley Access. They had a depot in Iver. Where's Iver?
Slough.
Yeah, but anyway, right next to the M25, you'd drive around the M25 and you'd see all these access platform booms sort of bristling by the side of the road. And this poor chap, I think he was checking a new machine, a boom lift, and it toppled over. And it was, I think, fully extended or very nearly fully extended. It toppled right over. There's actually a picture of the collapsed machine on our website, and the basket landed in the hard shoulder of the M25. And of course, Yeager Fossard was killed. It turns out, and I didn't realize this at the time, and I didn't, and I'm not sure I actually found out what the problem was, but they have decided that the problem, the cause of the accident was that the machine obviously has a sort of a safe working envelope, which is programmed into the onboard computer manually. So, and to quote your story, the miscalibration occurred through incorrect data being manually manipulated and uploaded onto the machine via a laptop using password-protected web GPI software. So basically, that data was wrong, and the operator was able to extend the boom at the wrong angle to a dangerous extent, and it toppled over, and that's what killed him. Well, pick up the story, Phil, because this is It's only now that this has actually been resolved, this issue.
Well, it's taken nine years, but the HSC had, right from day one, and we did quite a few pieces. I'm just going back through the archives of the Construction Index online. We ran four pieces between June 2013 when it happened and February 2014 on this. So there was a 6-8 months of the powered access industry going, this, the important lesson in this, we need to know what they are. And in 6 months after the incident, the International Powered Access Federation took up the cudgels and wrote to the whoever was the minister in charge of employment, health and safety, and Department of Employment, whatever it was then, saying, this is a bad thing. We need to know. We need the HSE to tell us what they found out. It needs to be made public because there's concern and confusion in the industry. The lessons have to be learnt now. And then the next story was a month later, it was actually then Mike Penning, who is the Minister for the Minister for Employment, and he said that the initial findings were that it appeared that the machine in question may not have been calibrated correctly. This may have allowed the basket to be extended to a position in which the mute became unstable. So that was, December 2013. So about 6 or 7 months after the accident, a government minister was telling the industry it was a calibration thing. He didn't say it was definitely, because there'd be, you know, legal issues or whatever, but he was basically saying,
sure,
this is the what you need to know. But Genie had already issued a safety notice to customers straight after the accident, saying you need to recheck your calibrations and recommend that the secondary boom angle range was checked on all machines as a precaution. Mm-hmm. So Genie immediately knew what had happened, and Genie was telling his customers, but not going public on it, cause didn't want to admit culpability. I mean, being an American company, it's the last thing you ever want to do is admit culpability. It's even worse than doing it here.
Sure.
The HSC then, in February 2014, so getting on for a year after 9 months after the event, the HSE put out a comprehensive safety alert, but then Kimberley responded to that, saying that the HSE safety alert didn't go far enough. Kimberley accused the HSE of stopping short of telling people what they need to do to prevent a similar accident occurring again. And what became the issue in the powered access industry is that it should be impossible to miscalibrate the machines, and there's some sort of electromechanical safeguard that you could add to them so that you couldn't miscalibrate it, and that's what the whole argument was. So essentially the technical argument and why it happened and what happened had all been decided within a year, early 2014. So that was 8 years we've known what it was. So why it's taken 8 years for it to come to court? I mean, sometimes it can take years and years and years of wrangling, and we've got to go back to demolition. We've got the Didcot power station collapse. I mean, that's awful. I mean, that also needs to need to pull a finger out there. But I think it did take longer to sort that one out, and less has come out about that for the industry to learn from than it did come out for the Genie collapse.
Yeah,
but why it should take 9 years from the event and 8 years since absolutely being all over the event, knowing why, how and who and when, to actually get to court is unfathomable.
I know. I noticed that the company, that Genie UK, that is, Genie UK Limited, was fined £270,000 and ordered to pay costs of just over £165,000. I just wonder, over the course of the past 8 or 9 years, how much money has been spent on lawyers and, you know, investigations, and how much this has cost just to bring it to court. I mean, I'm sure that you know, sort of less than £500,000 that Genie had to shell out will be a drop in the ocean compared to what's been spent bringing it to court.
Good point. Yeah, having those expensive lawyers on retainers for 9 years.
Yeah, well, they do say that the lawyers are the only ones who ever win. So I think that's probably absolutely true here.
But it's not the only one. I was looking back at other recent cases. I mean, nine years does seem to be, if not a record, then a recent particularly bad example, but we, in the past couple of months, we've reported on Anglian Water was fined £300,000 after pumping station breakdown polluted a river and killed more than 5,000 fish in Essex somewhere. That incident happened in June 2016. It came to court 6 years later. There was a 2015 case, November 2015. A roofer fell through a asbestos cement roof panel and two men got suspended prison sentences 6.5 years later. So that took, that 2015 case just came to court the other week, and that took 6.5 years for that to be prosecuted. And Volcarail was fined £550,000 after an employee was injured in a trench collapse. The fine was handed down in May last month. The trench collapsed in July 2014. So that is 6 years, 11 months, almost 7 years afterwards. So these sort of 6-7 years to get from, I mean, obviously the first one, the Anglian Water one, was Environment Agency, not HSE. So maybe, you know, maybe we shouldn't just blame the HSE. Maybe it's the entire legal system. And we've got barristers going on strike imminently, haven't we? And
yes,
everything's going to take longer there. And I know there was obviously the COVID pandemic pushed a lot of court cases back a couple of years. But it shouldn't be, especially half the time. You know, Genie pleaded guilty in their case. And in most of these cases, people plead guilty mainly because they're told to, because if they don't, it's going to be more expensive.
Yeah.
They have no choice, really.
Then it'd be settled quickly.
Yeah.
But it should be. It should be settled quickly.
But it's something needs to be sorted out. It really does.
Yeah, it's terrible. Okay, well, was there anything else that we ought to discuss?
Just an and finally item. I posted a news story this morning, which I must confess shouldn't be news at all, but it's news to me, and I figured I hadn't heard about it. Maybe other people hadn't, which is pretty much a good rule of thumb for treating news as news.
Yeah.
but there's, you know, they're upgrading the junction of the M25 and the A3 in Surrey by Wisley, Royal Horticultural Society, Wisley Gardens.
Oh, yeah.
And it's hugely controversial. I mean, it's a rubbish interchange because it's grade separated where you would have thought it shouldn't be. You should, you know, be able to drive straight off the M25 and the A3 and vice versa. So right. they're starting work on this later this year, and it's going to be... I got friends who live in that neck of the woods, and I've told them, look, I'll see you in 2030, because it's just going to be a nightmare around there, I'm sure of it. But anyway, as part of this scheme, as part of the mitigation measures to make it all lovely and friendly, because they're destroying lots of beautiful woodlands, they're going to reconnect Ockham Common and Wisley Common on either side. Because instead of just putting a little footbridge over, they've got this like 30 metre slab going over the M25, which is 5 metres of pedestrian way and 25 metres of garden. If you remember Boris's garden bridge
garden
in London
bridge,
he wanted to build.
Garden bridge.
Well, this it won't be as long as it, I don't think. So I don't think the M25 is as wide as the Thames is wide, that part of the Thames. Well, it's probably not far off, I wouldn't have thought. But it's a damn sight wider. I mean, I don't actually know the exact specification of the bridge, but I know that the verge is 25 metres wide. And this has been knocking around. I looked it up for a couple of years. They've been consulting, or you know, they consulted this bridge a couple of years ago. But I hadn't seen the picture. It was a picture that made me go, ooh. Okay, this is interesting. I mean, I think if I had read about it being a garden bridge before, I probably imagined it as being a normal footbridge with a bit of wisteria going over the side.
Yeah,
yeah, yes, yeah. Or, you know, ivy or something. Not a 25 metres of shrubbery. And it's fascinating, extraordinary. And the idea is to join up so that animals can get from one side to the other.
Okay.
So it's interesting. I don't know the cost.
Because Boris's garden bridge was extremely unpopular, wasn't it? And that was ditched in the end because it came in for some really severe criticism. I can't remember who the main critics were, but it was incredibly expensive, if I remember correctly, and served no real purpose.
There's a particular journalist at the Architects Journal who I should know his name, escapes me at the moment, but he absolutely led the running, getting the sort of unpublished minutes of, you know, council meetings and so on, and getting down to the cost of it. And it's all about the contracts were given to you know, Buggins's mate, and it was, nothing was put out to tender, and it was all, oh yeah, I'll do that, I'm your mate, Boris. Because someone came up with the idea. Was it Thomas Heatherwick came up with the idea, or Joanna Lumley came up with the idea and asked Thomas Heatherwick something? And they went to Boris and said, can we do this? This would be nice. Yeah, sure, that'd be great, yeah. And there was money, justification, transport need, why, planning.
None of that.
It was a nonsense. This has gone through all the proper processes and all the proper channels, as far as I can tell. Money has not yet been found or approved for it. That's the only thing. They've yet to confirm the money for it, but it's in the plan.
Okay.
And there's a suggestion there'll be a lot more of it, because the National Highways have just published a new design book, People, Places and Processes, A Guide to Good Design at National Highways. And it basically says that these garden bridges, which are aesthetically pleasing and lovely, we should be looking to do them, I'm paraphrasing here, but where you need to join bits of land up should do it nicely.
Oh, right, okay. Well, then they'll come along and fill them in afterwards, won't they? Maybe not. Filling in their own bridges.
What I reckon is the width of that bridge, I reckon you could get, probably if you stack them high enough, about 700 prefab houses on top of there.
Right, okay, why not?
So that's the future thing, but they have to be above the bushes, of course. You still got to get the deers and the rabbits and the whatever else.
They have to be on stilts
under them. Yeah, who can do that?
Yeah, it looks very nice. The picture of it.
It does. It's fabulous.
Very pleasant. Yeah, very nice. Yeah, I wonder if it'll prove as popular as Boris's garden bridge. Slightly different chalk and cheese, maybe. I think
it'll be used for dogging. That's my prediction.
Right, okay. Okay, right, fine. On that note...
Bombshell. Shall I sign off?
I think that's probably a good idea.
Well, once again, from Reconstruction, from David and I, thank you very much for listening. We'll be back again in 2 weeks' time, talking about something else, addressing whatever is in the news in the UK construction industry. We will see you then. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.